Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. He is, well, if you've read Discover Magazine or Astronomy Magazine, or if you've thumbed through the astronomical section of the Old Farmer's Almanac, you are already familiar with Bob's work. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob's most recent book, although he's got another one in the works he won't talk about, his most recent one is The Sun's Heartbeat. It's on Little Brown. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. It's wamc.org/voxpop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop or email us voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the phone number is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, ISON was a bust.
Yes, it was.
Comet ISON dissolved.
It was, and maybe more of a bust for us than for most people.
All right, explain what happened. Now, you know, it's funny. It went around the sun, as you said. The big question all those months ago will be whether it makes it around the sun. And the next day, well, first they were set up, it didn't make it. The next day, NASA put out a video, a little time-lapse video, said, oh, part of it made it around. What happened?
Well, at perihelion, when it passed less than one sun width above the surface, I mean, when you think about it, it's a ball of ice only a mile across. Is it going to withstand 5,000 degrees of heat and the huge tidal forces that are acting on it? Some said yes, some said no. Previous comets that are called sun grazers have made it and been spectacular in the week afterward, because that's just when they're going to release their trapped dust and it's going to fluoresce and they'll have two different types of tails. Others have not made it. So in this case, at first, all that came in the same orbit, of course, the stuff by inertia continues in the same orbit, was the embedded dust. The ice appears to have all sublimated. So all that dust that was trapped in, you had a cloud of dust. And so it looked like there was something there, but hour by hour, it faded. Ugh. Thanks to the inverse square law, it got fainter and fainter as it got away from the sun's brilliance. And then this it was like poof, this cloud of dust dissipated and grew fainter and fainter. Ugh. Until there's just not a trace of it.
So you went south to see it, and you actually did manage to see it before it went around the sun.
Exactly. That was the idea. We rented out a whole mountaintop in Chile in the Andes near the world's greatest observatories. We had professional astronomers standing by manning these giant telescopes. We had 90 people, 90 astronomy enthusiasts from actually a number of countries all around the world. Great bunch of people in two groups. First was November 1st. We did not see it.
Oh.
Even using our equipment, because the comet was still so faint then, we couldn't quite see it. And a week later, on November 6th, November 7th, we did. But it was nothing to write home about. Comet Lovejoy, higher in the sky and brighter, was more of a comet. And even that wasn't special. So comet, I was starting to really hate Comet ISON. It was, here's another comet like Kohoutek that just got your hopes
up. Or Halley the last time. It wasn't nothing to write home about.
You're right. We had a special thing in Woodstock at Andy Lee Field in the autumn of 85, and we saw Comet Halley, but it certainly wasn't spectacular, and this one was less than that. So even before perihelion, it was disappointing, and then here it is, poof, gone, and maybe the legacy of ISON is how not to hype these things too much.
You know? Well, it seems to be a fairly inexact science trying to figure out whether we'll even be able to see them. I mean, you go back to Kohoutek or Halley or this one, and, you know, there were some big predictions out that Kohoutek will be enormous in the sky. Where was it?
Right.
Hale-Bopp wasn't bad, though.
No, Hale-Bopp is nice. And Yakutake, one year earlier, was a beautiful comet if you were away from the lights of town. It spanned 90 degrees of the sky. That was gorgeous. And then we had a nice comet, McNaught, just a few years ago, 7 years ago, but not from here. It could only be seen in the southern hemisphere, unfortunately. So we get these so-called great comets. That's the name for them.
Right.
It's not just an adjective like swell or awesome. It's what we call them, great comets.
Yeah.
Once every 15 years. And
right.
The next one may even be en route toward us, and we don't know about it
yet. Well, that's a great point, because they only started tracking ISON a year or two ago, right?
Exactly. Discovered September 21st of 2012, only a year ago.
So is there the possibility of another one that we don't even know about?
Yes.
That'll be here in 2 years.
Yes, yes, yes. Of course.
And slam into us, hopefully not.
There's two types of comets. The periodic ones, meaning coming in less than 200 years, the brightest of which is Comet Halley with its 76-year orbit. And then the only issue, Ray, is when it gets around the sun, is Earth on the same side of the sun to see it well, or are we on the wrong side of the sun? And we were on the wrong side back then. We're not going to be in a great position in 2061 when it comes by next, but in 2137,
yeah,
that should be the best visit of Halley in 2,000 years. But then other than those periodic comets, of which Halley is the brightest, the others, like this one, has an orbit of 400,000 years. If it survived, we'd see it again 400,000 years from now. So there's no previous record.
It's rather sad that it died, yes?
I hated it.
Yeah.
I was ready for it to say goodbye to it. But if it had survived, it could have put on a good show this week. It, right now is when we'd be seeing it. Of course, when that happens, then we get the bad weather and
right.
We don't see it.
Well, boy, you're in a hateful mood on
comics. It must be.
You got the hate
be.
On comics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
all right, let's go to the phones
yeah.
and see if we can find a positive attitude. Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
All right, I got a positive attitude.
All right.
Did I see it on the day after Thanksgiving?
I saw
it? No. It was too close to the sun then. There's no way you saw it. You saw something else.
Oh, because I saw a big, almost like a third of the size of the moon.
Venus.
It's a big... a fuzzy ball.
Venus. Venus without your glasses on.
No. No, this was fuzzy ball. Round ball in the east.
No. The day after Thanksgiving, there was nothing left of it for any observer on Earth using any kind of telescope. You wouldn't have. Did you say 5:30? You mean p.m.?
A.M.
A.M.
When you were talking about to look for it, that's when I went out. The day after or Saturday morning.
And what direction were you looking to see it? Due east, a fuzzy
and it
ball.
Was probably three fistfuls high off the horizon.
Well, you did have Mars at that time. Was it orange?
But, no, this is huge. This is almost a third of the size of the moon.
And
I mean,
fuzzy.
It was big,
yeah.
A big, it looked like a dirty... cotton ball.
It was
just huge.
It was probably just a routine UFO mothership.
Oh, you know what, Bob?
Oh, come on.
Yeah, you know what, Bob?
Were you looking at it? Looking for it then?
No, it was not possible to see it. It would have been too close to the sun then, and it's a good thing I didn't because nobody saw it.
Oh, okay.
Well, sorry, Merle.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
All right, this is has to do with black holes. Andromeda supposedly has 14 black holes that are observable from us, but the Milky Way only has one?
Right.
And the reason was because they've had encounters with other galaxies. The Milky Way hasn't had other encounters with other galaxies?
No, we believe we've had encounters, too. We even think that the giant globular cluster Omega Centauri, it was a previous galaxy that we've cannibalized. But for some reason, we have a single giant black hole weighing the same as 4 million suns in the center of our galaxy. We don't know of a single galaxy that doesn't have a black hole in its center.
But is it uncommon to have 14?
Yeah, because these are smaller ones. See, they haven't. Maybe they will coalesce someday.
Oh, all right, hey, Merle, thanks a lot for getting us started.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Gregory in Kingston is on. Gregory.
Yeah, two nights ago on Tuesday night, I was coming home about maybe 5:30 or so in the evening, and the sun was setting, and it was spectacular. It was like a harvest moon. I'd never seen the sun like that before, and I was curious if you could shed some light on it. Pun intended.
Now, so in other words, the sun itself looked unusual, you say?
It was huge, like a harvest moon. And it was just hanging out there on the horizon. You didn't catch that?
Well, no, but here's the thing. When any object, the sun or the moon or even a constellation, Orion or the Big Dipper, is on the horizon, there's an effect called, oddly enough, it's called the moon illusion, even if it has nothing to do with the moon. And that's because we're used to objects on the horizon. We know they're far away. Like you're traveling on a highway over a hilltop, and there's the next town in the distance. And you see, it's got a little tiny church steeple, but we're used to something in the distance on the horizon being far. And so we give it extra size in our minds. So when the moon or the sun or a constellation is low, it looks enormous to us. And so this is a very common effect that you can make it go away by using a rolled up toilet tissue or paper towel roll, and you look at the sun or the moon or the object through that, and now it looks normal size.
All right, you really don't want to look directly at the sun for very long, though. Yes,
of course. Hey, except if it's really low on a hazy day, you know, we've all looked at the sun when it's looked red and been very low. You can take a quick look there.
Okay. Right, but I look at it, you know, the sunset all the time, and there was no sunset going on. It wasn't all the way down on the horizon. It was just a giant sun that was like a full moon. And you were able to look at it without it hurting your eyes at all.
Could there be some atmospheric prism effect that'll stretch it?
The sun never gets bigger from refraction effects. It changes its sizes. It changes its position, but never its size. It can squash it to make it oval, but never makes it larger. No, this is that psycho-optical effect, the moon illusion. It's very, even if you know what causes it and you're expecting it, it still looks enormous when it's low.
It seemed very strange, unusual, and just seemed special. I would like to ask another question while I'm on with you. I had called in the past, and I had asked you about something that you didn't really know about. I'm wondering if you researched it, whether you can shed some light on that now. And that was about the Fatima incident.
The what?
Fatima?
Incident, yeah.
So just prior to World War One, kind of a religious.
I think, is that Joe who's there with you?
No, it was, right. I think Ray knows more about this.
Well, it's
than
a
I
manifestation.
Do.
It was investigated by the Catholic Church. Right. People reported the sun coming down, basically, and drying the rain. And it was, I guess, I don't know if they finally classified it as a miracle. But anyway, we have to take a break. But a great topic for. Another conversation. Zach, let's hit the break now. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Whew. Off to a flying start with Bob Berman. More on the way.
Support comes from Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing 24-hour emergency and critical care for dogs and cats every day, including all holidays. VESHDeerfield.com. Woodstock School of Art, offering classes and workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, and more for all levels. Tuition assistance available. WoodstockSchoolOfArt.org. Ward's Nursery, Great Barrington. Fresh-cut trees, wreaths, roping, holiday flowers, and gifts for the gardeners and bird lovers. WardsNursery.com. And the Honest Weight Food Co-op, open at their new location, 100 Watervliet Avenue, Albany, offering local and organic produce, groceries, and more. Honestweight.coop.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Bob Berman across the desk, and he is our astronomical guest here today, and we love your calls at 800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go. It's Mark in Salem. Hi, Mark.
Hi. First, a hateful comment.
Oh, boy. Another hateful comment?
Yeah, well, not towards Bob, but one of my... I was trained in astronomy as an undergraduate. I got my degree in astronomy and physics at SUNY at Albany. One of the things that really bothers me is when I hear people who should know better refer to planets revolving around other stars as solar systems. The name of our star is Sol. And when you use the word solar system, it means it is a planetary system that is going around our sun. And so they should properly be referred to as stellar systems or systems that are revolving around a star and give the star its name.
Or extrasolar systems.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's always been a pet peeve of mine, and I hear it always makes me cringe.
All right.
The question or comment or that I'd like Bob to speak to is the, well, astronomers are something like Sherlock Holmes. You have to ferret out information that's very difficult. And one of the classics is the absorption lines that are in the spectrum of and I understand I got an A in a class because I said spectrums, and the professor said, no, it's spectra, and it turned out they were both right. So he made me bet if I would get an A or a B. It was Dr. A.G. Davis Phillips. And he said you were right. So,
oh, good.
But could he speak on the way this, the absorption lines of this of various stars, the width of the line, what forms them, and how we can tell, say for example, a supergiant from a small star by the width of the line, and
fair enough.
Just in general, a little bit about that, because I frequently get asked about how astronomers know so much about these objects that, you know, you can't see except through a telescope, and these solar or the spectral lines are the key.
Okay.
And it leaves people a little confused. Maybe it might help other people to understand that a little bit better.
All right, fair enough.
Sure,
Bob?
Sure. And I'll preface that by saying that spectroscopy is what astronomers do more than anything else. I know our caller knows that, but people still have images of astronomers looking at objects through telescopes when you learn so much more through using a spectrograph. For example, the largest telescopes in the world only show stars as points of light. So what are you going to really learn? Well, if it has a companion, it may bring that companion to light, but through a spectrograph, now suddenly the light is broken into its components. You see imposed on it dark lines called Fraunhofer lines or absorption lines, as the caller was just mentioning, and every element has its own signature. In fact, compounds do also, so that cool stars, not cool in the hip sense, I mean cool temperature-wise, can even have molecules like titanium oxide, whereas the hottest stars, which are most of them that we see in the night sky, the bluish stars, are so hot that you'll only see plain vanilla hydrogen, and hydrogen gives off just a few lines in the spectrum. The most famous is the line at 65, 63 angstroms, the famous one in the red line that we call the H-alpha line. But the pattern of lines.
I might add that they're very distinct. Too.
Very distinct. Absolutely. It's a pattern that you can reproduce in the laboratory. And then on top of that, if all the lines are shifted from their laboratory positions, that shows us if the star is coming toward us away from us. If it's a second set of lines superimposed, it tells us it's got an unseen companion. Or if the star is going around this companion and vice versa, they're going around each other, one set of lines will be blue shifted while the other is red shifted. And then we see the pattern reversing. So that tells us the period of rotation or revolution around these stars. So all these things. But now let's get to the specific question with that as preface. Why would the lines vary in their number? For example, a spectroclass G star like the sun has a lot of stuff in it. It's not just hydrogen. We see metals. We see magnesium and all sorts of other things. So there's lots and lots of lines that tell us that metals are prevalent, not just plain vanilla hydrogen in the lines. But here's the story. If the star is spinning faster, which early spectral types, the bluer stars tend to spin faster, this will broaden the lines.
Hmm.
If there's a strong magnetic field, this produces a thickening or even a doubling of the lines called the Zeeman effect, produced by a strong magnetic field. So much is gleaned from these spectral lines that nobody would think of looking at the star through a telescope when you can learn volumes by analyzing the light spectroscopically.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. Now, what about reflected light? In other words, if a telescope, say the Hubble, was good enough to see a planet, would you be able to get a biosignature or know some of the atmospheric content based on reflected light?
You can, because sometimes the light is absorbed. Some wavelengths are absorbed preferentially. For example, methane, let's say, absorbs light in the red part of the spectrum, which is why Uranus and Neptune, Uranus in particular, looks greenish and Neptune looks bluish green, because the CH3, the methane is actually absorbing part of the lines, and so we can tell what it's made of. And by that method, we've been able to ascertain that some planets, recently discovered extrasolar planets, contain a water vapor in the atmosphere.
All right, so in the quest for life, which goes on and on and on, that may be a promising lead. James in Monroe. James, you're on.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I got a three-part question real quick and easy, and then a separate question about solar flares. Are we expecting a big one? And does the solar flare, can that affect the genetic makeup on cellular structure on us? And, let's make it just two-part. And then the third question is, when the sun absorbs these stuff from space, like meteors and the ice and everything, does that change the structure of the sun over time?
Okay, let's work backwards. The sun is so massive, it weighs the same as 333,000 Earths, or if you want to actually give it a weight, it weighs 10 followed by 33 grams times 2 is the actual weight of the sun. It's so massive that even all the comets that might hit it, or material that could get sucked in, there's something called the Poynting-Robertson effect that makes little smaller objects in the solar system spiraling towards the sun. It's insignificant in increasing the sun's mass, especially because the sun is also giving off so much material in the solar wind.
Yeah.
Broken bits of atoms are streaming away from it at all points. So it's almost a wash. We think that the sun in its old age is pretty much going to weigh pretty much what it does now. The only thing that changes is the composition. As first hydrogen turns to helium, helium turns to other objects, gets fused into carbon and oxygen. And so we're going to end up with a star that's pretty much composed of a human breath. The sun is going to end up like one frozen giant human breath of carbon and oxygen, instead of it being mostly hydrogen and helium.
It's
the way
interesting
it is
way to
too.
Describe it.
And as far as the other part of the question, the solar flares, personally, it doesn't affect us, mostly because the sun's energy, even when it's during a solar max year like this year, although we've had a wimpy solar
very
max,
lame, yes.
A very lame solar max, we don't get the same strength as cosmic rays coming in, the results of the detritus from supernovae and in our galaxy and other galaxies. Only the strongest solar storms can compete in ferocity with the particles that are penetrating our planet and even our bodies from elsewhere in the galaxy.
James, thanks a lot. Now, I remember seeing an article not too long ago about a massive gamma ray burst from somewhere out there not too long ago. And I guess it just missed us, but they could theoretically do damage.
Right, because gamma rays are the bad boys of the neighborhood. They're the most powerful of the electromagnetic spectrum. That's right. And actually, the sun's core produces largely gamma rays. It's just fortunately for us, they get absorbed and re-radiated as they try to squirm their way out from the center. Mm. So by the time this stuff radiates from the sun's surface, and by the way, what we see when we see the surface of the sun, the gaseous surface, that's not producing energy. That's just where it's radiating out. We're just seeing the place where the stuff is leaving the sun. The actual furnace is hidden way down
inside the
inner 12% or so of the sun.
Bob Berman is our guest. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Tom in Springfield, New York. You're on. Tom? No? Is this Tom? Is this Springfield? Going once. All right, he's gone. Let's go over to Rich in Kingston. Hello, Rich.
Oh, hi.
Hi. You're on.
I got a question about the stars.
Great. You come to the right place.
Okay. Yeah, around 5 o'clock in the morning, I've been seeing this huge star off of Orion's foot, you know, pretty far away, but in that direction. And it's like the brightest star out there. What is it?
If it's really near Orion's foot, now the question is whether it's higher than Orion or sort of the same height or lower than Orion. So which is it?
I mean, I'm seeing Orion is basically upside down, right?
It's setting at that hour, right? It's getting low.
And it's pretty, you know how far I don't know how you pronounce it, Aldebaran is away, the one in Taurus?
Aldebaran, yes.
Yes. Okay, it's on that side of Orion, and maybe twice as far away as that Aldebaran is.
Okay, above that stuff is Jupiter these nights, which is really the brightest thing that's out in the morning.
Oh, really?
But below it is the dog star Sirius, the brightest true star.
Right. That's my other question. What happened to Sirius? Why isn't it the brightest star anymore?
Well, it's normally the brightest star, but Jupiter, which of course is a planet, as you know, this winter, since it's out, it's about six times brighter than Sirius is. Normally, Sirius is the brightest thing in the winter sky, but this time Jupiter is brighter than it. And we're close now to its brightest of the year. Jupiter will be at its brightest the first week of January, so we only have another 4 weeks to go, so it's really, really, really brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's out starting at about 9 o'clock at night in the east, and at the hour you're talking about, just before dawn, it's still very prominent and quite up. So the next morning that you really want to settle it for sure, because they're both near Orion, is Jupiter is brighter and it's a creamy yellow white, whereas Sirius is blue white.
Mm.
So you can see them both out and compare the two. It's a beautiful
color
comparison.
Well, I mean, I know
comparison.
Where Sirius is. It's definitely not. It's on the other side. Basically, Sirius is not on the same side of Orion as Taurus, right?
That's correct. Yes, yes. Taurus is to the right of Orion and Sirius is to the left. Or another way you can tell is that Orion's belt points towards Sirius.
Right.
Okay.
But this other star I'm talking about is on the off of the foot on the same side as Taurus, maybe twice as far away from Orion.
Yep, Jupiter.
Okay, but now it's always in the same relation to two other stars.
Well, it is this year because
the planets changed a lot. Like that.
No, they move slowly. Jupiter takes a little less than 12 years, 11.86 years to go around the sun. So it's in one constellation for a whole year.
All right.
And so it's in Gemini now.
Jupiter,
and
I've been saying that.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Rich, thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest, and Carl in Poughkeepsie is next. Carl.
Carl in Poughkeepsie.
Hi, Carl.
Fuzzball, somebody from Washington County reported earlier, was probably Comet Lovejoy, which got up to a +4 magnitude, and it was in roughly the position he described.
Well, if he could see it, an object that faint, you know, fourth magnitude, and it really stood out to him, I had dismissed it because I didn't think that a casual observer would be noticing Lovejoy, because it's just not that bright. But you're right, that could be exactly
so fourth
that,
magnitude is visible, and if it's
visible,
dark?
It's visible, but it's not bright. It's not stand out bright.
He's calling from Washington County, where he's blessed with wonderful dark skies.
Yeah,
you're right, it could have been that.
Yeah, that's
a good thought.
And you know, it was amazing. It was a short period there where if you had a telescope, you had four comets in the sky simultaneously in the same spot area.
Yeah, good for you. Actually, down in South America in the Andes, when ISON was such a disappointment, we were showing everybody Lovejoy in the sky and giving everybody a nice constellation comet.
Very good.
I wasn't sure if being as far south as you were, if you got any kind of a shot at Lovejoy when it came closest to Earth.
Yep.
Carl, thanks a lot.
A quick question. On the almanac, Bob?
The Farmer's Almanac or the...
With the solar maximum being so really inactive, are you predicting an excessively cold winter as a result of such a...
Well, you don't do the weather, do you?
Yeah, no, it's a funny thing that you're asking. About 20 years ago when the when the old Farmer's Almanac asked me to be the astronomy editor, at first I said, you know, this isn't going to help my career. You guys claim to predict the weather in Chicago 2 years in advance. This is nonsense. And I thought they were going to say something a little bit discrediting, like, yeah, I know, we make this stuff up, but everybody wants to hear it. But to my delight, they really believe it. They say, yeah, we use a formula, we use a sunspot thing, and we find that we're more accurate than the long-term forecast from the National Weather Service. And they really believe that. I hate to say the word nonsense, because that's my magazine, The Old Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah,
but
I hope they're not listening.
I hope they're not listening. In fact, I'm going to shut up right now.
Yeah, that's a good plan.
No, it's like the Maunder Minimum was followed by the Mini Ice Age.
In the 1600s, or was
that's right? It was 1645 to 1715,
yeah.
And there is some talk. You know, this caller is obviously knowledgeable about this. The fact that we've had now a very, very deep solar minimum, as we all know, instead of an 11-year cycle, we had closer to a 14-year cycle. We had the deepest solar minimum.
Where there were no sunspots.
No sunspot for hundreds of days at a time. No solar researcher alive has seen the sun acting this weirdly. Now, it's a whole human lifetime of not seeing this kind of anomalous behavior. Now, finally, here's Solar Max. It's a very, very wimpy Solar Max, and there is some talk, Ray, that maybe this is the beginning of an extended period of solar quiescence, of solar quiet.
Or perhaps the more robust activity from the sun in the first part of the century and even through the 20th century was an anomalous anomalous itself.
Well, that maybe, but
I don't think so. Going back to Galileo.
Yeah, you're going back all the way to Galileo.
Sorry, it's right. The sun cooperating to overcome global warming that is our fault.
Ah, all right. Well, hey, listen, we got to take a break, but Carl, thank you very much. Zach, hit the music. We'll be back with the home stretch and Mr. Bob Berman coming up.
Support comes from Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or visionexceleyecare.com. Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts. Joyellesjewelers.com. Edward Garbasek, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc and Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. Havocandwealthstrategies.com. And Ashokan, presenting a winter holiday festival and feast with Elizabeth Mitchell, Jay and Molly, Larry Campbell, and Teresa Williams, Happy Trom, and more. Sunday, December 8th at 4 p.m., ashokancenter.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest, and let's go right back to the phones, and it's Angeline. You're on.
Hey, hi. Mr. Bob Berman, you have really, like, directed my life. I saw Venus Transit because of you. I'm now trying to hunt down the Northern Lights. Drove up to St. Johnsbury a couple of weekends ago. Couldn't see anything. Nobody knows a thing about them. Got any advice?
Well, you never can know that. You never know that far in advance. We're watching the sun. Sometimes solar satellites that are in orbit, such as Source and the SDO and Stereo, are mapping the sun and can see the other side and can see when a giant solar storm may rotate into the side facing us. Then you have to wait another 2 weeks till it's right in the center of the sun. Actually, usually the center of the sun plus two or three more days of rotation puts it in the ideal spot to send us a stream of high energy particles that can cause an aurora. So this is a long-winded way of saying you really don't know a few weeks in advance whether you're going to get them usually. So when you're making your trip up there, maybe yes, maybe no. But at least you'll be in a better spot to see it.
Yes or no. But, and I thought I kind of planned it. That's what I did that weekend. But the thing is, I am on, like, the Aurora Borealis watch. But
good.
That's for Alaska. I can't find a website that gives me any information about Northeast.
You know what? Use the University of Alaska's website, because if the storm is strong enough to produce auroras there, they'll have illustrations of it. it might spread to lower latitudes and give us a storm here. Even though they're based in Alaska, it's still useful to us.
Alaska University website?
A University of Alaska at Fairbanks.
University of Alaska and, Fairbanks.
That's probably the best one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. And Doug in Poughkeepsie. Doug, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm just curious about the relation between the farthest object that we can see in the universe and the age of the universe.
Hmm.
Is the farthest object we can see about the same as the age of the universe?
Yes, as long as you characterize it as the age of the observable universe, since more and more evidence is pointing to the actual universe being vastly larger and perhaps infinitely larger than the universe we can see. So if we just say what we can ever see, hope to see, the light that can ever reach us, yes, then we're talking about something in the area of 13.7 billion light years away. And if galaxies and stars took a little bit of time to start forming, then the earliest stars and galaxies we can see is 13-ish billion light years away. And you could almost say that that's how far the galaxy is, but the truth is all that time that the light's been traveling to us, the galaxy has still been receding away from us. So in fact, it's closer to 38 billion light years away right now as we speak, even though the media commonly says it's 13 billion light years away. But so the light, let's just talk about the light distance is about 13 billion light years. That would be the extent of the observable universe in all directions, but the actual universe much greater than that, and perhaps even infinite.
And how old then the age of the universe is about? Sometimes they say it's around 13 billion years, but is that
right? That 13.7 billion years figure is when the Big Bang apparently happened, and that's with making the assumption that after it happened, the universe was opaque to light for a period of time. Appears to be about 350,000 years when light could not escape. You add that to it, and that would be the age of the observable universe. But again, if the universe is infinite, you can't get an infinite universe from a finite event, can you?
Right.
So it would mean that the Big Bang was just a local event in the hood. That's the observable universe. And maybe there were other Big Bangs in different stages that are simultaneously going off that we can't see that define other parts of the universe. And in a way, the Big Bang is still banging because the dark energy that we've known about since 1997, 1998 shows that there's a anti-gravity expansion effect that started the Big Bang going that's still around and still exerting its oomph on the universe. So the Big Bang actually is still happening in a way.
I guess I was always curious about, and maybe I shouldn't be, that if we're getting the light from that far universe at this point and it's 13 billion years, something would have had to travel faster than the speed of light to get to this point. You know what I'm saying?
Or? Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in the inflationary model, Alan Guth's inflationary model invented in the 1970s, it means in the first fraction of a second after the Big Bang, space itself expanded faster than the speed of light. So that gave everything an earlier oomph. And that's the only reason we have some kind of reasonable homogeneity of when we look in all directions, we see more or less the same thing because of that faster than light initial expansion. But it's very, very tricky because the galaxies we see that started off back then are much larger than they should be for an object that far away. And that's because just because it took a long time for the image to get here didn't change their size because the universe was much smaller back then.
Uh-huh.
Like if a FedEx person is delivering a photo to you and it gets delayed so it takes 5 years to reach you, the package is still going to be the same size. You're going to get the same size photo. So we see these giant galaxies that are just now arriving, even though they started 13.7 billion years ago, because the galaxy was much closer to us back then when the light started.
So if by this one scientist's theory, the speed of light was faster in the beginning, then is it possible it is slowing down or changing now?
It's not the speed of light that was faster. It's the expansion of space that was faster.
But it expanded faster than the speed of light.
That's right. That's right. And that's supposedly no violation of Einstein because there were no actual objects that were accelerated beyond light speed. It was empty space.
So no mass involved.
That's right.
Aha. Uh-huh. All right, let's go back to the phones. And looks like Saul in Schenectady. Saul. Oops, wrong one. Yeah, Saul.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, you're on.
Okay, my question is, about 2 years ago, I was looking in the southern sky. I live dead west of the Niskayuna Airport, and a bright yellow object moved by relatively quickly without any sound, and my guess is it had to be a weather balloon because it was sizable. And my question is, do you know if they launch weather balloons from the Schenectady County Airport?
Not Schenectady, from Albany, but the wind often carries it, and I'm an owner of a small plane. I'm a pilot myself, and I've just barely missed, on one occasion, a weather balloon that just went right by the plane.
Yeah.
In that area. Boom, scared the living daylights out of me. So, yeah, they launch them twice a day.
Okay.
Well, that's what I needed to know. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Saul. But, appreciate it. And Ed in Connecticut. Ed, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I had a question about how do astronomers describe where objects are in space? I mean, there's no north or south or anything like that. So obviously, something's based off a reference
great
point.
Great question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And you're absolutely right. There's no grid system in space. So within the solar system, we always do it relative to the sun and the Earth. Our orbit around the sun is considered the flat plane of the solar system. And so every planet has a orbit that's inclined to this Earth orbit around the sun. We call that the inclination to the plane of the ecliptic. It varies from Mercury is 7 degrees, Venus is 3.4 degrees, Uranus is only 0.7 degrees, etc. So it's the Sun-Earth that defines it. Now, once you get beyond that to the galaxy, then we use the whole galaxy itself as the reference. Where it gets tricky is when you get into intergalactic distances. So then we're egocentric in the sense of saying Andromeda is going, in that case, is coming toward us, actually, at 70 miles a second. So we say Andromeda is moving toward us, but we really don't know whether it's us moving toward Andromeda,
right,
or whether we're each moving at half the speed toward each other, because you're absolutely right. There's no grid system that defines absolute motion or location.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Ed, thank you very much for the call. It's 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. And you'll be making an appearance very close to the studio coming up this month, yes?
Yeah, right across the street. And on the 14th, Saturday the 14th, I'll be doing a benefit at the Linda on the topic of what is the universe. And we'll talk about the latest ideas in cosmology, some of them very surprising and non-intuitive of the last 10 years, to explore what is this place we've all been born into.
And what are you going to tell us what you think it is?
Well, we'll give the evidence and the different alternative explanations.
All right. But you won't give us your opinion.
Unless I'm asked.
All right. Somebody ask him. All right. It's on the 14th. It's at the Linda. Let's go to Dave and Amherst. Dave.
Hi, Mr. Berman and Mr. Graf. How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. Good, good. Great show as usual. Something about a hexagonal pattern in the clouds of Saturn. I don't know. It came through a news feed.
Yeah,
you know
weird.
What I'm... Yeah, yeah. It's weird. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Well, it's very weird. It's impossible to figure out why this should be, because on Saturn's south pole, there are normal round hurricane strength winds. And we're talking about winds that are stronger than cyclones. But on the north pole of Saturn, for reasons no one understands, is a giant hexagon. And it's a pretty darn good hexagon where each leg of the six sides is larger than the planet Earth.
Wow.
Greater than 8,000 miles on a leg. Now, past photos taken by the Voyager 2 spacecraft when it went by in 1981 show that it was there then.
Okay.
And we didn't really pick up on it. And now the Cassini spacecraft is showing that it's still there. So we've got a long-lived feature lasting at least decades. It shouldn't be there because there are winds blowing right through it. It's at least 60 miles tall. It rotates at the same speed as the planet's rocks below rather than having any relationship to the winds.
So it's magnetic then?
No, it wouldn't be magnetic. Well, I know what you're saying, because with a rotation, why shouldn't it have a magnetic base? But these are clouds. Now, 60 miles high is, there's no way to account for it. Now, you can think of snowflakes are six-sided figures, but it's a matter of scale. A tiny six-sided geometrical figure caused by crystals is one thing, but when you're talking about something that's thousands of miles on a side and that persists, there aren't even guesses except that maybe it's some sort of standing wave, but how do you get a standing wave like that that persists? So the caller's question about the giant hexagon, and it can't be seen from Earth because it's right on the top of Saturn at the pole, so you need a spacecraft to go up there and look down to see it. It's quite something, quite a mystery.
Dave, thanks a lot. And by the way, I've just been handed a note that if you want to see Bob Berman and ask him, you know, what is the universe? It's Saturday, December 14th at the Linda. It's a WAMC benefit event, and you can get a pair of tickets and a book for a $100 pledge. Go to WAMC.org, and that should be fun. Let's go back to the phones. Sean and Rhinebeck. Sean.
Hi, thank you. I just had a question. I don't know if we discussed this, about the effect that sunspots have on climate. Do you believe that there is an observable and actual effect that sunspot activity has on what the climate is on Earth?
Yes. This is discussed in great length. You know, my last book was The Sun's Heartbeat, and we spent two whole chapters on that. And it's tricky, because anytime you have two kinds of events and you don't have a lot of instances of those, with the 11-year sunspot cycle, we've only seen 24 cycles now since it's been observed, and you can match it up with thousands of earthly objects, wars and famines and food crops and the price of wheat, and we find that the sunspot cycle does correlate with the length of women's skirts in fashion.
Really? How are we doing now?
And the rabbit population of Australia, and the party that controls Congress. But what's coincidence and what's an actual correlation? And to answer the caller's question, what we think is a real correlation is, yes, weather. The Earth gets colder at times when there are fewer spots and hotter when there's more spots. And that's why the absence of spots lately has kind of come to our aid in global warming. Another caller mentioned this, and it's absolutely true that we've been given kind of a little bit of break by the recent absence of sunspots on the sun. It also seems to correlate with a change in the position of the Gulf Stream, that river of ocean water that moves at about 4 miles an hour up the eastern coast, and so influences our climate and that of Europe. So there are definite effects caused by the sunspots and the sunspot cycle on Earth. Yes.
Bob Berman is our guest. Let's try to get another call or two in here before we wrap up. Ed in Belchertown. Ed, you're on.
Oh, hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
My question is, you know, I'm kind of newer to this, everything about space and everything like that. And, you know, sometimes I look up and I'm seeing the sun and the moon in the sky at the same time. And I was just sort of wondering what the deal with that was.
Well, as the moon goes around Earth, it doesn't really care whether it's daytime or nighttime on Earth. So it spends an equal amount of time over an observer's location in the daytime and at night. We notice it at night because it's the brightest thing in the night sky. But the sun and the moon are out together. In other words, the moon is out in the daytime sky just as often as it is in the nighttime sky.
Okay, so that's not something that's uncommon.
No. It's just a matter of noticing and not noticing. It's, of course, harder to see against the bright blue sky.
Excellent. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Thanks,
yeah,
Ed.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
All right, let's go to Doug in Albany. Doug, you only have about 30 seconds here, and then we got to roll.
Okay, yeah. Well, I want to know your views on the ancient alien theory that ancient astronauts visited the planet in prehistoric times and are responsible for many advances of mankind, including a dramatic increase in brain size over a short period of time.
Well, this is a perfect way to end the show. Bob, what do you think?
What do you think, Ray?
What do I think? I don't know, but I do watch those shows. They're very interesting. A couple of martinis, you watch the Ancient Alien show. It could be worse on a Tuesday night. I don't know. Well, you answer, Bob. You're the expert.
No, well, I don't think there's any expert in this. I've not seen any real science evidence that we've been visited by ancient aliens. But, you know.
What a good way to wrap. Hey, Doug, thank you. I wish you had called earlier. We would have had a whole show on it. Hey, thanks a lot, Doug. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Okay. So we've gone from the sublime to the ridiculous, and now it's time to wrap up the show. Bob Berman will be at the Linda Norris Auditorium Saturday, December 14th. Do you know what time that show is?
I think.
Is it a show? Do you dance and such?
I'm going to dance.
Yeah.
It's going to be dinner first at 7.
Oh, beautiful.
Food at 7.
Okay.
And then the exploration of this topic.
What is the universe?
What is the universe?
And if you want to go and see that, you can make a pledge of $100 to WAMC. You get two tickets and a book. Go to WAMC.org to find out more. Bob Berman, thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
A pleasure, Ray. Thank you.
Let me put my glasses back on here. Support comes from somebody. Yes. From HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, weekends December 13th through December 22nd, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com for information. Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, hosting a holiday open house this Saturday and Sunday featuring holiday dish gardens and holiday plants and bulbs, Monday through Saturday, 8 to 5, Sunday, 9 to 4, a gardener's destination, storiesnursery.com. And Smith College Museum of Art, presenting second Friday, December 13th from 4 to 8 p.m., featuring activities for children and adults on the exhibit River of Gold, Pre-Columbian Treasures from Setoa County, smith.edu/artmuseum. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the controls with aplomb. Thanks to Patrick Garrett, who answered the phones. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at this time, it's Moyers and Company. And next week on Monday, Alan will be back at the helm here, and he'll have a Medical Monday for you. Stay tuned now for a news update.